You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible. 14 lectures translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 11, given in Munich on the 16th of May, 1912, entitled Synthesizing Worldviews, A Fourfold Herald. Spiritual science must become an instrument of mutual understanding, a means by which we can, right across humanity and deep into souls, learn to understand one another. This learning to understand deep into each soul must permeate us, must be alive in us as an anthroposophical attitude and ethos. Otherwise, those occult truths, which must flow into humanity through spiritual science, will be unintelligible also to us. In this sense, spiritual science can, because it is like the key to understanding our most inward aspects, create peace and harmony on earth. How can it do that? Let us demonstrate this in a concrete example. Take the relationship of two people in the world who have two differing religious beliefs, let's say Christianity and Buddhism. What can be said of Christians and Buddhists, as a classical example, can of course also be said about the worldviews and beliefs of two people living next to each other in Europe. For what applies to the great also applies to the small within spiritual knowledge. If we take a Christian and a Buddhist in their traditionally orthodox beliefs, how do they relate to one another? Well, in the way that the Christian is actually convinced that Buddhists can only attain happiness if they adopt Christianity in the form in which they themselves have adopted it. This is how Christian missionary activity takes place among Buddhists. They transport their particular beliefs to them. In similar vein, do Orthodox Buddhists behave? Imagine that both of them become anthroposophists. How can the Christian, as an anthroposophical Christian, relate to the Buddhist? Let's say they hear all about the main tenets of Buddhism, which can only be rightly understood by someone fully within Buddhism. Nowadays, there are two ways in which one hears about various religious beliefs: from those who study comparative religions, and from those who learn about differing beliefs through spiritual science. Focusing for a moment on those engaged in comparative religion, one has to admit that they are extremely diligent and active people, engaged in academic evaluations of differing religious creeds. When they carry out these comparisons, something odd transpires. What they are seeking, even though they do not admit to it, actually turns out to be non-truths about those religious beliefs. They seek out what is untrue, what was believed by various religions in more childlike times, in other words, what is not true. A spiritual scientific researcher will look for the primary core in each religion, will seek for what, albeit, exists as a single nuance, but which is a nuanced perception in this or that religion. Put differently, they will look for what is true in each faith rather than for what is untrue. In this respect, it can turn out strangely. Isn't it the case that nobody in possession of the facts will have anything but respect for the most prominent among comparative religion academics, perhaps the greatest expert in his field, Max Müller? Even he did not produce much apart from what can be called the falsehood of Oriental faiths. Yet he believed that he was conveying everything comprehensively. At this point, H.P. Blavatsky stepped forward, speaking in quite different terms. She spoke in such a way that one could see that she was conversant with the core truths of Oriental faiths. What did Max Müller make of this? His judgment is somewhat grotesque and proves that an academic does not need to be exactly clouded by logic. He opined that people flocked after, quote, the Blavatsky, close quote, that she gave them an utterly false, distorted depiction of Eastern religions, in total disregard of true portrayals, such as, for instance, those promulgated by himself, Max Müller. He made the following comparison. When people on the street see a normal pig grunting, they are hardly surprised. But seeing a person grunting like a pig causes quite a stir. Wishing to compare what Oriental religious systems naturally bestow, namely his version of comparative religion, that is, the naturally grunting pig, needless to say, I am not making this comparison, with Madame Blavatsky's contribution, that of a human being grunting pig-like. Now, I don't wish to comment on the refinement of such a critique, as it doesn't seem particularly cogent to me. I might be slightly surprised at someone grunting convincingly. But I would not, absolutely not, couch the discipline of comparative religion in terms of the said animal. It is strange that Max Müller himself should do so. Spiritual science acquaints us with the true core of the various religions. Let's take Buddhism as our starting point. A Buddhist knows, if conversant with the roots of their faith, that bodhisattvas exist, that these bodhisattvas, starting as individualities, make a swifter ascent than other human individuals in attaining Buddhahood. Buddha is a general term for all those who, during a corporeal incarnation, rise from bodhisattva to Buddha. One among them who is especially identified by the name of Buddha is the son of Suddhodana, Gautama Buddha. One has to recognize in him one who, in the 29th year of his life, attained to Buddha virtue, that the incarnation during which this occurred would be his last, and that he would no longer be obliged to return to earth in physical incarnation. All this is perceived by the Buddhist as being true. A comparative religionist would see this as childlikeness. To anthroposophists familiar with the mysteries of religions in different fields, Buddha does not appear in such a guise because they recognize the truth in this. In this respect, anthroposophists relate to Buddhism in the same way as a believing Buddhist, saying, yes, I know that bodhisattvas exist who rise to Buddhahood and no longer need to incarnate. This is an item of faith in your community, and I recognize it just as you do, and inasmuch as I do this, I too can look upward and revere Buddha. The anthroposophical Christian starts fully to understand what Buddhists profess and shares the same feelings and sentiments. They understand one another, at least in this respect. Let us now take the contrasting case in which the Buddhist has become an anthroposophist, who now understands what Christians who have gone beyond the earthbound orthodoxies familiar to denominational Christianity also know about Christianity, assuming from the outset that this anthroposophical Buddhist has heard what a Christian of this kind has to say about Christ's impetus itself. They hear that within esoteric Christianity, it is understood that in the course of earth evolution, what is known as Lucifer approached humankind as part of their human evolution. They hear that through this, humanity descended further than would have been the case without such luciferic influence. Further, they hear that we look aloft as if to a circumstance of the gods when we focus on Lucifer's rebellion and outrage in face of the progressive gods. We are actually looking at a circumstance of the gods. And then we hear from the Christian who really understands their faith that the compensatory balance for this divine situation, playing out as it does between the progressive gods and Lucifer, had to be what we know as the mystery of Golgotha. Why was this so? Well, in its present form, death, and all that pertains to death, really came about through luciferic influence. Death is something which can only be found on physical earth. There is no death in supersensible worlds, inasmuch as it is accessible to human beings through clairvoyant consciousness. Not even do the group souls of animals die. They merely transform. They metamorphose. Metamorphosis exists, but not what we call death. Death in the form of decay and dissolution of parts of an entity only exists in the physical world. By way of a compensatory force, supra-earthly beings had to choose, and this can only be hinted at, an experience of undergoing death in order to establish community or common circumstance with human beings, something that would create a balance for the luciferic outrage. In order to triumph over Lucifer, divinity had to undergo death. For this to take place, divinity had to descend to earth. What took place through the mystery of Golgotha is therefore a concern of the gods, through which recompense for Lucifer's activities could be created. This is the only divine situation that has played out in full view of humanity. This unique impetus can be portrayed in no other way than that a divine being underwent death on the physical plane, and that Christ's force has been streaming out into the earth's atmosphere ever since. This is now seen as the original and fundamental element of Christianity by the Christian who understands their faith. What distinguishes Christianity, when grasped in its deepest aspects, from all other religions is that other religions view their genesis in the figure of an original founder or instigator, in a personality. But in Christianity, the founding core is not the personality of Jesus of Nazareth, but the fact that this personal founder is only the bearer of the Christ impulse, that Christianity sees as its central fundament a deed. This can only be grasped with all possible intensity. As a deed that had to be fulfilled just once in all earth evolution, in a divine God undergoing death. This constitutes the exceptional nuance of truth in Christianity, that its origin was not an individuality, but a deed, an event, an experience. For this reason, it does not concern us if someone says, "Well, just look, Jesus of Nazareth had all sorts of passions, all sorts of qualities, which, let us say, in the manner of Eastern views, someone advanced should no longer possess." This is not what matters. In Christianity, Jesus of Nazareth is not at issue, but the deed. The event on Golgotha is the issue. Just let the founders of other religions have their personal qualities. Let their merits please other folk better than those of Jesus of Nazareth. But those who, as Buddhists, become anthroposophists will see that everything in Christianity hinges upon the event on Golgotha, and they will reciprocate in kind the respect they were given. They will say, "Just as you concede that there are bodhisattvas who self-develop as individuals and rise to Buddhahood, never again to reincarnate, so we concede that once in human evolution a god underwent death. You grant us the nuanced truth of our religion. Likewise do we grant you the nuances of truth in your religion. Both understand each other." However, they would not understand each other, and peace would not break out, were Christians who deemed themselves to have become anthroposophists to say, "I don't believe that Buddha will never reincarnate. I assume he will, at some point, return to a corporeal body." That would be an impossibility for one who understood the very kernel of Buddhism. A Buddhist might reply, "You do not understand Buddhism." It is quite obvious, and beyond discussion, that just as little does someone who states that Buddha will return in the flesh understand Buddhism as the other who states that Christ will return in the flesh comprehend Christianity as a unique life of a divine being whose purpose it was to undergo death on the physical plane, and nothing else. We are talking about mutual understanding right across the world, about real comprehension, and through it, peace. Strife would be the result of claiming to a Buddhist that Buddha would return to physical existence. Strife would result from claiming Christ could return to physical life. Such claims would need to retaliate at a deep level, because they are impossibilities in terms of what really lives in human evolution. It would be grotesque to suggest that Christ would return and that people would understand him better than they did then, and would prepare themselves better for his return, and this time would not need to kill him. Such a view would be unaware that it was precisely a matter of death, and that without it there would be no Christianity. Goodwill toward understanding really does lead back to mutual understanding, and we see that spiritual science can be an instrument for finding the prime core of all religious faiths everywhere. If one has the will to find it, one will surely do so. This makes it a message of peace across the earth. Spiritual science will add to the material cultural body, today consisting of industrial and commercial relationships worldwide, a cultural soul element, which can span the globe. It is precisely because we can recognize the manifold ways in which the various religious faiths have endowed humanity that we continually apply to them all what spiritual science can furnish us with in terms of their core truths. Precisely by these means do we arrive at a kind of synthesis, a union, a consolidating fusion of varying worldviews in our time. This is underlined in just one point. It has never been the intention within the anthroposophically oriented movement we are creating to portray the differences between religious faiths in such a way as to apportion merit to one to the detriment of another. They are simply characterized. How often has it been said that the spiritual heights attained immediately after the catastrophe of Atlantis, in the culture of the ancient Indian rishis, has not even now been reached? Such heights in the form that they now exist have still not been attained in Christianity. We are not apportioning merit nor fault when we describe each religion in its very essence. We are merely describing when we draw attention to other differences. If we follow a more oriental way of thinking, such as that adopted by most people of a Buddhist faith, you will notice one thing. The main focus of interest is on what one can call the passage through many incarnations. One speaks of a bodhisattva, but a bodhisattva is not one who lives only between their birth and their death, but one who returns ever and again until eventually attaining to Buddhahood. One speaks of bodhisattvas as if they appeared in varying numbers within human evolution. There, one tends to generalize, seizing more upon each enduring individuality. What has been the prevailing tendency hitherto within Western conceptions? Precisely the opposite. When people spoke of Socrates, Plato, Raphael, or Michelangelo, they were denoting personality. Western views placed each individuality centrally within the limits of their circumscribed personality. That had its advantages, in that it educated toward chiseling out, exploring individual human personalities. This was fundamentally the case in outlooks which H.P. Blavatsky did not understand, such as the ancient Hebrew and New Testament perspectives. Look, for instance, at Elijah. Occult research uncovers something surprising about him. I need only say that his uniqueness is notable in that he appears as a forerunner of what needed to take place through Christ's impetus. He still conceives of the matter as the divine being expressed through the folk ego. Yet he already draws attention to the fact that the most worthy means of recognizing this lies within the I, capital, itself. In this sense, Elijah is to be thought of as a forerunner of Christianity, and no prophet other than Elijah seems to me to be a similar herald. He still retains Jehovah overtones in his words, yet in Elijah's words, Jehovah has moved as close to the human eye as was possible. Let us look at another figure, another unique personality, John the Baptist. We see how he foretold Christ's impulsion, how it is John the Baptist who characterized in words this stimulus of Christ. He enjoins us to change our ways, not to look back to the times of ancient clairvoyance, but to seek the kingdom of heaven inwardly within the human soul. John the Baptist frames in words what constitutes Christ's influence in reality. He is a herald of Christianity in the most wonderful way. What lives at the heart of John the Baptist appears to us as a sort of advanced teaching, advanced spiritual schooling, by contrast with what lived in Elijah. Let us now turn to Raphael, and we see him as seemingly quite a different figure from John the Baptist. But in looking at Raphael, we only need to immerse ourselves in him a little on a human level, we again find in him a herald of Christianity. Take the following. Let's open the Acts of the Apostles, where Paul is amid the Athenians, and where it is related, Acts 17:22. Then Paul stood and said, quote, "Ye people of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. You have an altar with the inscription, To the unknown God. God that made the world and all things dwelleth not in temples, but in words to the effect that I say unto you that the unknown God is not told of in his reality by outer signs nor symbols, but resides in all living things in creation. He is the God who lived on earth and arose, and through his resurrection will lead humankind itself to its own resurrection." Close quote. The Acts of the Apostles tells further, and we still see Paul amid the Athenians, how some believed and others did not. Among the first to believe was Dionysius the Areopagite. Then we can look at a painting by Raphael, which is hanging in the Stanza della Signatura in Rome, now called the Stanza di Raffaello, Apostolic Palace in the Vatican, and known as, titled, The School of Athens. We can assume, as was quite natural in those days, that Raphael had the passage from the Acts of the Apostles just mentioned in front of him. It came alive within him. Now look at the various faces he gave the Athenians, and right down into the hand gestures, we see the stepping forward among the Athenians, a figure whom we can recognize if we can only focus on Paul in the Acts of the Apostles. We could examine the most varied aspects of Raphael in this way. If we look at his series of Madonnas, we might wonder, isn't there one strange feature about Raphael? He is great when he paints scenes depicting becoming, developing, and growing in the beginnings of Christianity. The small Jesus child, as if containing the germ of all future Christianity. However, we find none of Judas's treachery in Raphael's paintings, and no bearing of the cross, as his painting of this subject appears, as if assembled in compilation, and not at all like other works by Raphael. On the other hand, his title Annunciation, his Ascension, and the like, all point to what is in process of becoming in Christianity. How do these speak to people? They speak in a highly singular way. You know that one of Raphael's most glorious works can be found in Dresden, the title Sistine Madonna. Short-term thinkers might imagine this painting to have arrived in Germany like a victor. It made little impression on Goethe, because he had heard what most people thought at the time. As a young man, Goethe was not as confident in his judgment as he was in his maturity, and was susceptible to what others believed. What did museum officials tell him in Dresden? That the child wore a mean expression, that the Madonna had been overpainted by some amateur, and that the little putti had been added by a handyman. This was the general consensus on the Sistine Madonna when Goethe visited Dresden in his youth. But look at it now. See what Madonna has become for people. He worked in Rome at a time when articles of religious dogma were fiercely debated. The way in which Raphael paints Christian mysteries is interdenominational. If we take the later great Italian painters, we see religious mysteries painted in a way that makes us imagine this is the Christianity of the Latin peoples. Raphael paints in such a way that we are clearly dealing with the most universal representations of Christian mysteries, which transcend cultures or ethnicities. Thus we see that within a short time the Sistine Madonna had, even in Protestant areas, settled into souls. If anthroposophy is to work toward understanding Christian mysteries, it will find its best access through souls in whom sensitivity is alive, souls who are moved by paintings such as the Sistine Madonna, in souls who are prepared in this way. And if we say nowadays that Christianity is only in its developmental infancy, that its true stature will only be understood through the spiritual key which anthroposophy can provide, then we know that Raphael stood as a herald in relation to this Christianity. And now we can turn our gaze toward yet another figure, and in so doing we turn to someone completely Western in outlook. Let us turn to the German poet Novalis. If we look at his work, we find throughout his oeuvre predictions of the purest anthroposophy, right into the details. One just needs, as it were, to disentangle them. One sees how Novalis is permeated with anthroposophical Christianity. Today we have brought four figures into focus as personalities. That was a Western approach. Now we come to a process of spiritual scientific deepening. Through this we can experience, for instance, why Raphael felt as if magnetically drawn to being born on Good Friday, so that his birth would signify externally that he had something to do with the mystery of Easter. Such things can only be hinted at today. In only a few decades, people will see such things as are being stated here in the same light as scientific facts are viewed, namely, that it is the very same individuality who inhabited Elijah, John the Baptist, Raphael, and Novalis. First, they will recognize the personality and then the individuality who has persisted throughout. Now we can grasp this fourfold harbinger, this herald, and its ascent. Now we can relate to something of this nature differently from before. Nowadays there is an awareness that the paintings in Rome's stanza are no longer in their original form, but have been spoiled by hands other than Raphael's. In a few centuries, they may not exist. Even though reproductions may give them a longer life, what that individuality created will be lost at an atomic level. Though Raphael's works may turn to dust over time, we know that the individuality who created them was present again in Novalis and treated their content in renewed form. So we see how what a Western perspective made of the limited personality can be augmented by the individuality. How what is best in Western outlooks can be enhanced by what is best in Eastern viewpoints. This is the way evolution strides forward over time. To the extent that humanity marches onward and gains insight into these matters, will the spiritual world not remain silent, but will also speak to humankind in their more everyday phenomena. People will not, as it were, just need to advance themselves toward the spiritual world through types of knowledge, but will increasingly transform such knowledge into what one can call lived experience. For this to happen, a truly spiritual movement is essential today. That this is vital is shown plainly by the fact that even the simplest things are no longer evaluated correctly. One detail will be highlighted today. Human beings, if they are healthy, go through a cycle of waking and sleeping over 24 hours. We know that on falling asleep, physical and ether bodies remain lying in bed, and that astral and ego take their leave. What happens to what remains in bed? When the clairvoyant looks back from their astral body into what is taking place in ether and physical bodies, they see how a more vegetative life begins, a life that is actually disturbed by day consciousness. Tiredness is balanced. In other words, blooming and burgeoning now thrives in ether and physical bodies when astral and ego are withdrawn. When these sink back into ether and physical in the morning, it is their task to tire them once more. They allow what is grown and burgeoned during the night to be grazed down and to wilt. Everything in the microcosm also exists in its macrocosmic form. When we see how in spring the earth is clothed in green, how plants thrive, how leaves and blossom burst forth, preparing for fruit, what are we witnessing? Someone used to making external comparisons will say that waking up in the morning is like nature waking up in spring. Yet the opposite is true. We should be comparing the flourishing in spring with falling asleep. We should be likening the springtime burgeoning and sprouting of plants with what takes place in human, physical, and ether bodies on falling asleep. When nature becomes ever more verdant toward summer, this is like human physical and ether bodies in the midst of sleeping. Autumn is similar to the human being diving back into their physical and ether bodies, causing wilting in what had flourished during spring. One needs to associate correctly what takes place within and without, avoiding superficial metaphors that link spring with waking up and autumn with falling asleep. Quite the reverse. So, we can say, those who are the spirits of the earth fall asleep in spring and awaken as earth spirits in autumn and winter. In winter they are bound up with the earth as earth spirits in order to arise in spring and summer into the heights of the heavens, into astral heights, and onto the other side of the world. When we experience spring again, they return to sleep. This does not contradict the fact that the earth is asleep now in this hemisphere, now on the other. Something similar also applies to human beings. Those who can follow these processes clairvoyantly will see that spring resembles humans falling asleep, where each individual spirit withdraws into the astral world. They see how in spring what we have called earth spirits withdraw into the astral world, and vice versa. Yes, today's humanity, those present, accepted, would probably burst into hilarity on hearing about the spirits of earth as they wake and fall asleep. You can credit modern humans with doing everything possible to prove that they haven't the faintest idea about real-world processes. This hasn't always been the case, by no means, and was once quite different. The primal clairvoyance used to see such things as they really were. It saw that earth spirits withdraw in spring and rise to cosmic heights, descending again in autumn. This was visible in ancient times, when it was natural in midsummer to point to something like an absence of actual earth spirits from the earth. Conversely, elemental nature spirits shoot upward, paroxysm-like, leaving behind a terrestrial corporeal part of the earth, which manifests through what is sense perceptible. One can do no better than to place the festival of St. John precisely at this time to illustrate how the upward rushing nature spirits are at work, and how the actual spirits of the earth, who are the I and the astral body of the earth, are absent. How do matters stand at the approach of winter? The earth wakes up and is connected with its astral body and I. Festivals associated primarily with human spirituality are therefore best set during this season. This is why Christmas takes place in winter. Then when the earth spirit leaves for the heights, which is the implication at Easter, people would ascribe this taking leave of the earth, this entering into astrality, to the relationship between sun and moon. In looking into all these questions, we are united in a wondrous way with ancient clairvoyance, showing us what can be seen when elements of ancient times jut into that human connection with primal divination. Materialistic perspectives find it natural to opine that they need only to nurture their bodies. They say that it is inconvenient for us in terms of banking procedures and such like to have the Easter festival sometimes early, sometimes late in the year, and this should be regulated so as not to disrupt commerce and industry. They say, let's insist that Easter be celebrated on 1st April every year. That would just suit a materialistic age devoid of all connection with the spiritual world. Just as it suits materialism to foster such ideas, it is equally true that a spiritual movement must protect the connection with the time-honored setting of humanity's festivals. We will not in any way be prevented, especially with regard to practical activities, from doing what is commensurate with a spiritual view of the world. This needs to be expressed in everything that is planned for you in our title, Soul Calendar, which will, of course, seem risible to the world at large. Nor do we wish to deprive them of it, even though they consider us fools. The calendar expresses how we need to hold fast to our connection with ancient times. In the illustrations created by one of our dear and honored members, you will find a renewal of what had become dry and barren. Imaginative depictions relating to sun, moon, and the constellations of the zodiac, revitalized for modern souls, and rendered, if you observe the sequence of weeks and days, so as to convey something of this vitality. Were you to ask yourselves, how can one conceive of this oneself? Just look at the soul calendar, whose mediations are the result of many years' occult research and experience. If you activate these verses in your souls, you will see that what constitutes the connection between potency of spiritual worlds and your souls will be established over the course of time. Readers aside, I read the word mediations as it is in the book, but it may possibly be whose meditations are the result of many years' occult research and experience. I'm not 100% sure. End of readers aside. What we call the mystery of Golgotha has been treated exoterically, externally, so that it would not shock on first viewing. We created an arc all around it, on which 1912, 1913 is marked. But inwardly the calendar is designed so that the birth of the human eye stands at the beginning. In other words, with the mystery of Golgotha. In addition, the way the year has been reckoned makes it uncomfortable for commercial purposes, but as it is necessary for spiritual life, from Easter to Easter. In this way, something has been created which has grown out of our way of thinking and which is useful to those who, by using it, can devote themselves more closely than via other means to this path toward the spiritual. It will become ever more obvious, working from a base of unified principles and common fundamental motivation, how issues undertaken within our anthroposophical movement are actually thought through, how each person here is not merely present on a whim, but is disposed, like single building blocks, to connect themselves with and to join in the totality of our work. For this to happen, it is of course vital that in more and more members the light of awareness for this cooperative work is activated, and that every one of us transcends our specialist interests and personal ambitions to direct ourselves increasingly to what unites us. It is, of course, understandable that members have many personal wishes and aims, things which one person or another wants to bring to the anthroposophical movement. But particularly here, in this place, where selfless cooperation will be needed, if we are actually to bring to fruition what is planned, it must become deeply rooted in our hearts that we can only work productively if our niche interests do not take precedence over what we can contribute to an overarching success, to what benefits the whole, in the manner of the building block simile. Otherwise, no composite whole can be created. This is so exceptionally important. In this context, I believe it would also make real what ought to happen, forming a blueprint for the way in which the anthroposophical movement should evolve. Today I tried to present to you some aspects of our anthroposophically oriented outlook, and in doing so we have created something of a substitute for what was to have taken place this time, but which could not happen, because not all the contractual consents were available, namely, for laying the foundation stone for our Johannesbau, our St. John's building. Let us hope that we can make up for this at a not-too-distant point. Perhaps we will also, at the same time, be able to lay a foundation stone to revivify the anthroposophical movement as it is intended within the Western world. If we succeed in doing what is right in this respect, then we will be able to offer proof that in every authentic sense of the truth, with which alone we wish our souls to be filled, and without any bias toward sensationalism, we can adopt as our own such occult striving as is needed by today's humanity for its onward development. The end of Lecture 11.